Welcome to episode 133 of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for August 6th, 2009. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. On this week's episode of the Fredcast, thoughts and prayers of cyclists all around the world are with Eldon Nelson, the fat cyclist, and his family. Plus, Tour de France 2009 wrap-up, a bunch of pro cycling news, upcoming cycling events, a new Colorado law going into effect, new West Hollywood law cracking down on cyclists, cyclist hit by lightning, and a helmet saves a cyclist from a bullet. Following the news, upcoming events including some charity rides surrounding the Tour of Utah, and it's finally time for the final Training with Ken segment, or should we say, Riding with Ken, as he completes the 2009 Étape du Tour. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Hey, fellow Freds, cyclists, and cycling fans, it's great to be back with you. This is David. Welcome back to another episode of the Fredcast. I am sorry that the episodes in July were a bit sporadic. We were all a little bit busy. Not only was I traveling for business and family and all those other great things that happen in the summertime, but there's a little thing that goes on in July that definitely takes up a lot of time, and well, that's the Tour de France. But nevertheless, great to have you back with us for another episode of the Fredcast. Now, before we get started with this week's show, want to bring a couple of things to your attention. That is that we have partnered up with Team Land Rover Orbea and also the Utah State Chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society and Contender Bicycles in Salt Lake City to put on a couple of great events before and during the upcoming Tour of Utah. We'll get into those dates in a little while. But first, have you ever wanted to know what it was like to train with a professional cycling team? Or have you ever wanted to ride in the team car with the Pro Peloton and the Caravan during a professional cycling stage race? Or have you ever just wanted to go for a ride with me? Well, now is your chance, and you can do each of these things and help raise money for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. That is a cause that, you know, if you've been a listener to the Fredcast for any length of time, you know that MS touches my life every single day. So anything that we can do to raise money for MS is greatly appreciated. First, we're going to be doing a training ride, a team training ride with Team Land Rover Orbea on August 12th, starting at about 6 o'clock at night, starting at Contender Bicycles in Salt Lake City. Details are on the web. I have links in the show notes. Participation is limited to the first 100 registrants. It's a $25 registration fee. That donation helps support the Utah State Chapter of the National MS Society. And you will get to ride with Team Land Rover Orbea as they go on a team training ride. And then we will come back to Contender Bikes and have dinner, all included in your $25 donation. The ride's going to last about 60 to 90 minutes. Every ability is welcome. This is a no-drop ride. As a matter of fact, you know, just to help you out, I'll ride at the back, you know, just to make sure that we sweep everybody along. So hope you'll join us for that if you are in Utah. Now, if you're not in Utah, or even if you are, and you're a professional cycling fan, you've heard me talk about how great it is to watch a professional race from right within the Peloton, right within the Caravan. Well, the great, kind folks at Team Land Rover Orbea are auctioning off one seat in a stage of your choice at this year's Tour of Utah in their team car. You may remember last year I had the amazing opportunity of riding with Noreen and the rest of the team in their team car as we did the Queen stage, rode from Park City on up through Sundance, up and over and into Draper, Utah, and then up to Snowbird, about 12,000 feet of climbing or so, over 100 miles, an incredible day of riding and racing. I was tired just sitting in the car. If you're interested in having that kind of an experience, we've got an auction on eBay with all proceeds going to the Utah State Chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. If you're in Utah, here's a great opportunity to bid on a once-in-a-lifetime event. And if you're not in Utah, jump on Southwest Airlines and get over here and bid on that auction. If you win, it really is a once-in-a-lifetime event. Once again, we thank you for your participation. We thank Team Land Rover Orbea, the National MS Society, and Contender Bikes for making this happen. Bid, join. Thank you so much for your support. Well, let's get right into the news for this week following that announcement of those rides. And topping the news is a very sad bit of information that I've got to bring to you. For those of you who have ever heard of Eldon Nelson or Susan, his wife, or the fatcyclist.com blog, you probably are aware of what I'm about to tell you. Now, Eldon started his blog a number of years ago as a way to document his desire to ride his bike more and lose weight, hence the name Fat Cyclist. And along the way, Eldon, who has an amazing ability to convey emotion and humor through his writing on the blog, along the way, Eldon really endeared himself to cycling fans and even non-cycling fans around the world. Over the months and years, he also started to document his wife Susan's battle with cancer. And Eldon, through his team Fatty, through the Live Strong Challenge, has raised over $500,000 for the Lance Armstrong Live Strong Foundation. It's a fantastic achievement. And Eldon really has conveyed everything that his family has gone through, the ups and downs of Susan's treatment. And it became common for you to see tweets and Facebook posts with simply two words, "Win Susan," as people were encouraging Susan to win her battle against cancer. Even the most famous cancer victim himself, Lance Armstrong, was frequently quoted on his Twitter saying those very same words, "Win Susan." Well, last night at 7:25 p.m., Susan Nelson passed away. And now, Eldon Nelson and his family find themselves having the virtual arms of the online cycling community wrapped around them in an amazing hug on Twitter, on Facebook, in the literally thousands of comments on the fatcyclist.com blog. As a matter of fact, Twin Six, the clothing company who has created a lot of Eldon's fatcyclist.com t-shirts, with much of the proceeds going to the Lance Armstrong Live Strong Foundation, today on their homepage at twinsix.com was simply the word "win" with a little tear falling off of the word "win." Many of us have read Eldon's blog and laughed along with him and cried along with him and his family as they've gone through the trials of Susan's treatment for cancer. And last night, there is no doubt by the way that Fat Cyclist and Susan were trending on Twitter that the entire cycling community was coming together. From my own family, from my heart, my thoughts, my prayers, my family's thoughts and prayers go out to Eldon and his family as I also wrap my arms around them and wish them peace, wish them strength in this very difficult time. And I urge all of you, if you have the ability, to donate to this very important cause. And this show tonight is dedicated to Susan and to Eldon and to their family. Right on, Susan. I hope that everyone who encounters this awful disease is able to fight like you. And there's no doubt that as difficult as that news is, and as much as it's touched the hearts and minds of so many cyclists, I think that Eldon would probably say, just get on with the show. So that's exactly what I'm going to do. It's time to talk about my wrap-up of the 2009 Tour de France. Now, many of you Twittered and emailed and said, what happened to the daily tour this year? That's my daily podcast. And the fact of the matter is, as I've said so many times, life gets in the way of podcasting. I simply didn't have the time. for the Daily Tour this year. I would love to bring it back again next year. Only time will tell. But let's talk a little bit about this year's Tour de France. Now, of course, if you haven't or if you weren't able to follow this year's Tour de France, you should know that Alberto Contador was able to wrap up his second Tour de France victory. Of course, he didn't have the opportunity to defend last year because of Team Astana's being banned from last year's Tour de France, but he was able to win this year's 2009 Tour de France. And he won this year's Tour de France in 85 hours, 48 minutes, and 35 seconds. Second place going to Andy Schleck from Luxembourg and Team Saxo Bank. He was 4 minutes and 11 seconds back. Now, you may remember Andy Schleck from last year. Andy was the rider that many of us said, we need to watch this guy because of the way that he was simply able to power up the mountains as he was then, as Team CSC Saxo Bank's lieutenant and domestique pulling for the other team members of the team. This year, he was the team leader, coming in second place in the overall general classification. Third place going to a name we all know, Lance Armstrong from the United States and Team Astana, Alberto Contador's erstwhile teammate. He was 5 minutes, 24 seconds back of Contador, and I'm going to get back to that situation in a couple of minutes. Fourth place to Great Britain's Bradley Wiggins from Team Garmin. He was 6 minutes, 1 second back. An amazing performance from Wiggins because he was primarily known as a track racer, and he really was mixing it up with some of the best stage racers in the world and definitely holding his own. Fifth place, Andy's brother Frank Schleck coming in fifth, 6 minutes, 4 seconds back, again from Luxembourg and Team Saxo Bank. There were many stars and standouts in this year's Tour de France, but one name kept coming up, and that's Great Britain's Mark Cavendish, who won 6 stages of this year's Tour de France, including the final stage on the Champs-Élysées. Cavendish ending this year's Tour de France in 131st place, 3 hours, 21 minutes, and 54 seconds back of Alberto Contador. In the green jersey this year, Cavendish did not take those points. He was beat out by 10 points by the God of Thunder himself, Tor Hushovd from Norway and the Cervelo Test Team. Third place in the green jersey points went to Gerald Sciolek from Team Milram. For the polka dot jersey for the best climber in this year's Tour de France, it was Franco Pellizotti from Team Liquigas with 201 points. Second place going to Igor Martinez from Spain and Euskaltel. And third place going to Alberto Contador from Team Astana, 126 points. Of course, the best young rider in this year's Tour de France in the white jersey, there's no doubt about it, going to who else? Andy Schleck from Team Saxo Bank and from Luxembourg. I have to say, at the end of the race, I definitely had mixed feelings. We'll talk about that again in a moment, but there's no doubt that I was really excited for Mark Cavendish and his 6 stage victories. At the end, in the final press crush, he said, quote, "The Champs-Élysées is a dream for every sprinter in the world. To cross the finish line in view of the Arc de Triomphe with your arms in the air, it was a beautiful feeling. It was a proud feeling, and to win made it even more beautiful. It's one of the most spectacular feelings, and it didn't disappoint me." Well, the other thing that didn't disappoint in this year's Tour de France was something called the Lance Effect. We talked about it with the Tour of California, and it was definitely true at the Tour de France. The Lance Effect had, well, quite an effect on a lot of different aspects of this year's race. As an example, live morning coverage on Versus this year was up 98% over last year, with nearly 530,000 viewers. According to Bicycle Retailer and Industry News, that compares with more than 267,000 from 2008. Not surprisingly, traffic on Versus.com increased 118% over 2008, with the site delivering more than 13 million videos, doubling the amount from 2008. Again, that from Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. Now, I'm not surprised about the traffic on the site. Quite honestly, most of my viewing of this year's Tour de France was on the Versus.com website. I thought that the quality was decent. I was watching it in the free version, so I wasn't able to do the full screen edition like a lot of our friends were able to, but I thought that it was a fantastic offering. It was commercial free. What more could you ask? So I thought Versus did a really good job this year at the Tour de France, and of course, they were benefiting from the Lance effect. Christian Prudhomme, the director or the chief of the Tour de France, also talked about the Lance effect, saying that he felt that Lance added an interesting element to this year's race. He said, quote, he has tactical intelligence and is always where he needs to be in the race. Armstrong is someone who is dangerous on all kinds of stages. As a matter of fact, even the French people themselves seemed to really embrace Armstrong in his return to the Tour de France this year. Lots of Livestrong bracelets, lots of signs and support for Lance Armstrong along the route. Even Nicolas Sarkozy, the leader of France, also had some complimentary things to say about Lance Armstrong. He said, quote, people say I'm not the same rider I was 4 years ago. They probably like that. And it pleases me too. It's the best way to sum up the situation. As a matter of fact, at the end of this year's race, Lance Armstrong, in a very candid moment, said, I'm happy and overall damn pleased how it turned out. Alberto was far superior than any riders, and Andy Schleck rode a very consistent and smart race. He then went on to say, for an old fart, coming in here and getting on the podium with these young guys was not so bad. And speaking of the French and Christian Prudhomme declared that this was, at least so far, a doping-free Tour de France. And considering the last couple of years, that is excellent, excellent news. He said, there will be other positive cases. That's just the way it is in sport. But coming through the Tour without having to deal with scandal was pleasing. I really think things are changing. The targeting of riders and the biological passport means that nowadays it is far more difficult to cheat and get away with it. Great news considering what's gone on the last couple of years. However, during this year's Tour de France, it was announced that Italian rider Danilo De Luca was provisionally suspended by the UCI after failing two drug tests for EPO, or CERA, C-E-R-A, the new version of EPO, during this year's Giro d'Italia. Basically, they had retained samples that De Luca had provided, and as a result of the tests on those samples, he was found provisionally positive. According to a statement from the UCI, quote, these adverse findings were a direct result of a targeted test program, just like was mentioned by Christian Prudhomme a few moments ago, conducted on Mr. De Luca using information from his biological passports, blood profile, previous test results, and his race schedule. The provisional suspension of Mr. De Luca remains in force until a hearing panel convened by the Italian Cycling Federation determines whether he has indeed committed any anti-doping rule violation under Article 21 of the UCI anti-doping rules. And after the Tour de France, it was announced that Spanish cyclist Mikel Astur Loza, who won stage 16 of this year's Tour, was also suspended by the UCI following an out-of-competition drug test. And of course, Astur Loza denied any involvement with doping. At a news conference, he said flatly, I haven't taken anything illegal. He said, I will do whatever it takes to find out where the supposed positive result came from. Now, interestingly, these results were announced following only a test of his A sample, not following the test of his B sample, and of course, he has requested that that B sample be tested. However, regardless of the outcome of that B sample test, Astur Loza said that he had lost faith in the system and that it was sporting suicide, those are quotes, to use drugs in this day and age. Of course, if his B sample does come up positive, then he does face a 2-year ban from cycling. Well, on the last show, I mentioned that I had some comments about the Tour de France that some of you might find controversial, or at least you might not agree with. I sort of teased some of those comments in a very brief sort of podcastlet or mini podcast that I did back during the Tour de France as I was driving down the road through Indiana and uploaded something called an audio boo, which is simply a little podcast that I can record on my iPhone and then instantly upload that you can listen to. And then I tweet it. So if you're following my Twitter feed, twitter.com/Fredcast, you'll know when I put these audio boos up. But I sort of teased my thoughts about this year's Tour de France. Here's a little bit of what I had to say. And speaking of teams, I also have a lot to say about Team Astana. In a nutshell, I'm having a little bit of a problem with the whole Armstrong versus Contador versus Leipheimer concept. I mean, stage racing, bicycle stage racing, is a team effort, despite the fact that one racer rides away at the end of the race with the yellow jersey or the green jersey or what have you. It really is a team sport. While Cav may be the fastest man in the world, it does take his team to get him into the right position and give him the right lead out. And the same can be said for Lance or Levi or Alberto. If they expect to be the last man wearing the yellow jersey on the Champs-Élysées, they need their entire team. And if they're each competing against each other, well, that works against the entire team and the possibility of one of those men winning the yellow jersey. Now, so far, they've done well. Now, that's what my comments were just about a week or so into the 2009 Tour de France. And by the time the tour was over, I have to be honest, I was a bit disillusioned at the way that Team Astana really fell apart. And I think that there was enough blame to go around on both sides. Again, let's start with this whole Armstrong versus Leipheimer versus Contador concept, which was all over Versus. Versus hyped this thing as high as they possibly could. Now, I understand they're a TV network and they're all about ratings. But again, from my perspective, stage racing is about team unity. Look at Saxo Bank. The reason why they have been able to be so successful is because they work well together as a team. Again, think of Mark Cavendish. The reason why Columbia HTC was able to be so successful and get Cav into the right position to win six stages this year is because they worked well together as a team. And I don't think anybody in any stretch of the imagination can say that Team Astana, the one team that had the eyes of the world on them for the entire 3 weeks of this year's tour, I don't think anybody can say that they worked well together as a team. Now, before this year's Tour de France, it was announced that Alberto Contador was going to be the leader of the team. Almost as quickly as that was announced, it was just as quickly buried, and a new story came out that we're going to determine as we go into the race who the leader of the team is. From my perspective, and no, I am not a successful cycling team manager, director sportif like Johan Bruneel, so I'm only talking from a fan's perspective, albeit I think I've got a little bit of history behind me here. No, I'm not Johan. I'm not even close. Nevertheless, it seems to me that if you're a coach, a director sportif, if you're a team manager, the worst thing is to walk into any sporting competitive situation not knowing whom your team is supposed to support. I think that that can be the recipe for disaster. Worked out this year for Astana, but I think that that's a mistake. And as a result, you had what appeared from the outside to be much of the team working for Lance, Contador feeling on the outs and feeling like he had to work for himself. Let's look at a couple of things. For instance, let's look at stage three. Stage three, a very windy day. Lance goes off with the break and is able to stay with them. Contador is left back with the main group of the peloton. Now, some people might say, what was Lance doing? Wasn't he there to be the lieutenant, to be the support for Contador? If he was, why was he going off on a flyer? Now, at the end of the stage, everybody said, well, Lance has won seven Tours de France. To Lance's credit, absolutely he has, and he's an amazing cyclist, and therefore he's able to read the peloton better, read the winds better, and that's why he was able to go off. But if the team leader was Contador, shouldn't Lance have used that knowledge and that skill to help Contador make sure that he made the break? All we heard was praise for Lance. There was no criticism for him. And absolutely, I got to praise the guy. He can read a Peloton. He knows how to read the right moment to make the move, especially on a windy day like that when the echelons are forming. Great move. My only criticism was, if indeed Contador was supposed to be the team leader, Lance should have helped bring him along with him. Now we go to stage 7, when Contador has the opportunity to go off and get ahead with the break. At the end of that stage, Lance is quoted as saying, that wasn't the plan. Levi is quoted as saying, that wasn't the plan. Johan Bernil quoted as saying, that wasn't the plan. It seemed to me that at that point, it must have become clear to Alberto Contador, as it became clear to a lot of fans, this fan included, that Astana wasn't working for Contador. And if Contador wanted to win this race, he was probably going to have to go out there and work for himself. As a matter of fact, the exact quote from Lance Armstrong at the end of stage 7, quote, that wasn't really to the plan, but I didn't expect him to go by the plan, so no surprise. So by this point, it's probably becoming clear to Contador that he's got to win his own race. He's got to ride for himself if he wants to make sure he's in the yellow jersey. Plus, there's all sorts of rumors flying and back talk about a lot of discord in Team Astana, and it seems very clear. Now, jump forward to what was the queen stage of this year's race as they're heading up the Col de la Colombière, and Alberto Contador, riding with his teammate, Andreas Klöden. There seems to be some discussion going back and forth between the two of them. Remember, by this point, Contador's thinking, if I'm going to win this thing, I probably have to ride for myself. Now, he rides up to Klöden and they exchange some words, and it looks like he then attacks, and it looks like he's attacking Klöden. Going with him were the Schleck brothers, and as a result, at the end of the day, with Contador and the Schlecks finishing 1, 2, and 3, it ended up leaving Klöden out of the possibility for a podium in Paris and the possibility for Astana to sweep the podium going 1, 2, and 3. Contador says that he spoke with Bernil. As a matter of fact, he says, quote, I spoke with Bernil about it, who told me to speak with Klöden. And he told me that, yes, attack if I wanted to. I thought that I might be able to go alone or just with Andy, but the only one who stayed behind was Klöden. That's why I decided to stop, as he did, to see if I could come back. But in the end, he lost a lot. And the Schlecks used this to their advantage, and they went, trying to take the advantage away from Astana and hopefully catapult both Andy and Frank onto the final podium in Paris. Not quite sure what happened here. It's entirely possible that Klöden told Contador to go for it. Bernil and Armstrong seem to be saying that they said no, there was no reason to attack that day, and as a result, it gave the Schlecks the possibility of keeping Astana, as they did eventually, off that final podium in Paris. So at least to this outside observer, it seemed that there were jabs and punches going from both sides, both the Contador side and the Armstrong side. But what was interesting to me was the reaction of the press and the general public. When it was Armstrong making the move, typically there was support. When it was Contador making the move, typically there was criticism. Here's another example. You'll recall, if you've been listening to the Fredcast for any length of time, that back in September of 2008, when I was at the Interbike trade show, you remember that Lance Armstrong made a repeat announcement of his return to professional cycling. Having done it the day before in New York City at the Clinton Foundation, he decided to come in front of the cycling press and do it again. You'll also recall that seated in the front row, right on the aisle, at that very same press conference was Greg LeMond, former Tour de France winner from the United States. LeMond expressing very firm doubt about Lance Armstrong's abilities and seeming to imply, not seeming, but implying that Lance Armstrong may have had his athletic achievements through the use of performance-enhancing drugs. And when Lance, rightfully so, verbally shoved Greg aside and moved on to another question, and you can go ahead and listen to that if you go back into the Fredcast archives. Everyone agreed Lance did the absolute right thing. Well, after stage 15 of this year's Tour de France, a very similar thing happened to Alberto Contador. Greg LeMond was there. Greg LeMond was going around doubting the performance of many of the cyclists, including Alberto Contador. And when Contador was asked to react to those doubts that were raised by Greg LeMond, he said, "I won't answer this question." When another reporter repeated the question, he said, "Otra pregunta, give me another question." When asked to reveal his VO2 max, the exact same question that Greg LeMond asked Lance Armstrong in Las Vegas in September of 2008, when Lance basically said, "Give me another question, let's move on, we don't want to talk about this again." When Contador was asked about his VO2 max, he said, "Otra pregunta, give me another question." And Contador was criticized. Was he trying to hide something? And this fundamentally was my problem with the way that people reacted to this year's Tour de France. If Lance says, and again, I respect Lance, I think he's an amazing competitor, I think he's an amazing athlete, and I think what he has done for the cancer community and for keeping cancer in the forefront of people's minds, and the fact that he won seven times in a row, the most difficult athletic event in the world, the man is to be respected and honored for that. My problem is the reaction. Lance has achieved, Lance is seen as a hero and a savior, both in athletics as well as in politics and in advocacy. And as a result, he gets a pass on these questions. But when it comes to Contador, he gets criticized. Lance attacks, he gets honored. Contador attacks, criticized. Lance refuses to answer the question, honored and respected. Contador refuses to answer the question, and he gets vilified. That, ladies and gentlemen, was my problem with the performance of Team Astana, if you can call it a team, in this year's Tour de France. And then, when the race was over, it got even worse. Lance skips the team party, honoring the race winner, Alberto Contador. After that, the war of words escalated, both at press conferences and on Twitter. It became a dogfight, and it became extremely distasteful. And personally, I think that it may have hurt the reputation of both of the riders, and perhaps of professional cycling, and certainly of Team Astana. And so for me, this year's Tour de France honestly was a bit disappointing. Again, I think it's fantastic that we have a champion repeating. I think it's great that we have what appears to have been a clean Tour de France. I loved watching Mark Cavendish and his achievements, winning six stages. Bradley Wiggins and what he was able to achieve this year. Listen to the commentators and their shock and surprise and awe of Bradley Wiggins and what he was able to accomplish. The Schleck brothers, as a matter of fact, Team Saxobank in general, for their teamwork and what they were able to do. There were some amazing achievements in this year's Tour de France. For me, however, it was overshadowed by the schism in Team Astana, the one team that everybody, including I, was watching in this year's Tour de France. Of course, there were also some sad moments. The moment when Levi Leipheimer went down and had his injury and was forced to leave the Tour de France. The horrific crash of my favorite racer, Jens Voigt, who thankfully is going to make a full recovery and says he'll be back at next year's Tour de France despite his advanced age. I put that in air quotes. Because he said this was no way to end a career in the Tour de France. Great that Jens is going to be better. Great that he's going to be back in the Tour de France. But it really was a horrific crash. Or the sadness at George Hincapie not being able to gather a yellow jersey of his own on stage 14. And then the heroicism of George Hincapie finishing the last few stages with a broken collarbone. A lot of memories of this year's Tour de France, bitter and sweet. And as always in cycling, there's a lot of great stories that can go on in a three-week stage race. And this year's Tour de France brought us the entire spectrum of those stories. Well, following the Tour de France, the next major cycling event was the Clásica Ciclista San Sebastián, which took place August the 1st, and this one going to Carlos Barreto from Team Quickstep in 5 hours and 37 minutes. Second place going to Roman Kreuziger from Czechoslovakia and Team Liquigas in the same time. Third to Mikel Delage from France and C. Lance Lotto 7 seconds back. Fourth place went to Peter Velits from Team Milram 7 seconds back. And fifth to Ryder Hegdahl from Canada and Team Garmin Slipstream. Next up and ongoing right now is the Tour of Pologne from August 2nd through the 8th. I'll be bringing you those results on the next episode of the Fredcast. Well, after all of those events leading the world rankings, it's Alberto Contador from Team Astana with 527 points. Second place in the world rankings right now, Andy Schleck from Team Saxobank, 334 points. Third place, Roman Kreuziger from Team Liquigas, 310 points. In fourth, Mark Cavendish from Great Britain and Team Colombia with 304 points. And in fifth place, it's Alejandro Valverde from Spain and Castapania with 295 points. And speaking of Lance Armstrong, the man in yellow, he's currently sitting in 24th place in the world rankings. As far as the teams are concerned, Team Astana, no surprise, in first place. Second place currently, Team Saxobank. Third, Liquigas. Fourth, Team Colombia HTC. And in fifth currently, it's Castapania. As far as the nations, Spain is sitting in first place, Italy second, Australia in third, Germany in fourth, and Russia in fifth. The UK is in eighth place, and the United States is in ninth. Upcoming cycling events, well, we talked about it earlier, the Tour of Utah is coming up August 18th through the 23rd. Also, if you want to follow the Tour of Utah, there's a great iPhone application, which I recently downloaded, and I put a link in the show notes to where you can find that. It's got all of the riders, the teams, the stages, the elevations, some news information, a dashboard. It's a great way to follow the Tour of Utah. Go ahead and check that out in the show notes. The Tour of Missouri is coming up September 7th through the 13th. And of course, the third of the annual Grand Tours from August the 29th through September the 20th. Everybody's looking forward to the Vuelta a España this year, being televised by Universal Sports, just as they did with the Giro d'Italia. And they will also be streaming that live on the web. Go ahead and check out the show notes for links on all of those races and the events. And finally, after a half an hour wrapping up our professional cycling news, sorry folks, there's been a lot since I've done a regular episode of the Fredcast, there's a new group that's been formed. It's called the Global Organization of Cycling Equipment Manufacturers, or GOSEM. And this is a group of cycling equipment manufacturers that has been formed with the goal of providing a unified voice for the cycling industry, specifically in dealing with UCI rules. According to a press release from the organization, quote, cycling equipment manufacturers represent the largest and most influential contributors to both the cycling industry and professional cycling, providing approximately 100 million euros annually in sponsorship, product, and support. Manufacturers have the greatest investment and a vested interest in the success and growth of the sport. This according to Phil White, co-founder of Cervelo and one of the coordinators of the GOSEM founding group. Now, according to Claudio Mara, general manager of FSA and a coordinator of the GOSEM founding group, GOSEM is a global organization that has attracted universal support from Asia to Europe and North America. We've seen tremendous interest from the international community of cycling equipment manufacturers. GOSEM was formed as a coalition of manufacturers who are affected by the UCI's interpretation of its rules and regulations. And initially, it will consist of manufacturers who supply equipment to Pro Tour and Continental Pro wildcard teams. This is an important development when it comes to professional cycling because the UCI has a habit of interpreting and reinterpreting its rules, a lot of times catching teams and manufacturers out and really keeping innovation from the sport. Keeping innovation from the sport also keeps it occasionally from the floor of your local independent bike dealer. So there is incentive not only on the professional cycling side, but also on the enthusiast side as well. I think that this is a positive move, and looking forward to seeing how GOSEM deals with UCI regulations in the future. Well, speaking of rules and regulations, You know, I like to talk about advocacy and laws that affect cyclists. A new law went into effect yesterday, Wednesday, August 5th, in the state of Colorado, requiring drivers to give cyclists at least 3 feet of space when passing or risk a $110 ticket. According to Dan Grunig, the executive director of Bicycle Colorado, the buffer is going to give cyclists flexibility to maneuver around road debris and deal with other factors like wind. He was quoted as saying, quote, "Even wind from a passing vehicle can cause bicyclists to change their course a bit. So providing that safe distance helps ensure that if there's a rock or pothole in the biker's way, they're not in the way of a car, too." Now, in addition to the 3-foot law, there's also a provision for road rage. Anyone who throws an object at a cyclist could be charged with a Class 2 misdemeanor, and that carries a fine of between $250 and $1,000 and a possible sentence of 3 to 12 months in jail. Now, with this new law and with the increasing tensions that seem to have come about as a result of this law, Boulder County, Colorado, has appointed their own cycling liaison to try to reduce potential tension between drivers and cyclists. According to the Boulder County Sheriff, this new cycling liaison's position has become necessary in order to handle those conflicts. According to consultant Jonathan Barsh, quote, "We're looking at very specific things that can be done to reduce tensions, whether it's sweeping the streets more frequently or better signage. We want to do some very practical things." Sheriff Joe Pella said that the outreach efforts are aimed at calming escalating tensions. He said, quote, "There's definitely plenty of responsibility on both sides of the debate. We're going to see if we can't fix some of this." Now, the blame, again, goes on both sides, because according to the sheriff, they've been really monitoring the situation and studying the behavior of drivers and the behavior of cyclists on the road. He says they've been following large packs of cyclists for several weeks, evaluating what the biggest problems are and how certain groups are giving other riders, like you and me, a bad name. He said, quote, "They're really disregarding essentially all the traffic laws. They're not doing the cycling community any good." So folks, let's remember, a lot of these laws are out there to protect us, but it doesn't give us rights that are really any different from other users of the road. Yes, we get that 3-foot buffer, but we still have to stop at stop signs. We still can't ride 4 or 5 abreast. We still can't run stoplights. Remember, if we are good cycling citizens, and I've said this so many times, if we are able to set a good example out there on the road for our other cyclists and also for drivers, we're going to start minimizing some of these conflicts that can occur out there on the road. And some of that bad behavior that we see from fellow cyclists is what prompted, you'll recall, what looked to be potential civil disobedience during a group ride that was going to be taking place in Boulder County, Colorado, earlier last month. Well, thankfully, that civil disobedience, as I reported earlier on the Fredcast, did not occur. So good news for those of you who participated in the Boulder County Sunrise Century, and hopefully, if we can all start being, as I said, good cycling citizens, we won't have to worry about these kind of threats again in the future. Next up, seems like I have a lot of Boulder news this week. A 44-year-old cyclist was struck by lightning in north central Colorado while training for a triathlon, and she is out of the hospital after temporarily losing her sight and the ability to use her arms. Terry Mangini said she had finished 78 of 100 miles on her bike on Monday in Boulder when she saw a dark cloud overhead and lightning in the distance. She said she was on the crest of the hill when lightning struck within 100 feet of her. She said, quote, "There was one lightning bolt, and within a minute, the second one got me." Now, Terry's the mother of 5. She says she lost consciousness when she woke up. Her vision went from blurry to black, and she couldn't move her arms. She was taken to the Boulder County Community Hospital and was released on Tuesday. She said, "I was lucky, so I'm going to go buy a Powerball ticket right now." But She was disappointed when doctors said she couldn't compete in a half triathlon that she was planning on being in this Sunday. They're monitoring her heartbeat, which was erratic when she was first admitted to the hospital. But it does look like she will be able to compete in the Ironman triathlon later this month. Terry was quoted as saying, "My training, I'm still going to do it. I've been an athlete my whole life, and I'm not going to stop that." Good for you, Terry. Sorry to hear about your accident, but glad to hear you've got a great attitude and that you'll be able to go on with your triathlon. And finally tonight, you know, we talk a lot on the Fredcast about wearing a helmet when you ride every time you ride because you never know when it's going to save you. From a bullet, however, police in Asheville, North Carolina say that a cyclist was shot in his helmet after an argument on Sunday morning. The shooting happened just before 11:30 a.m., and police said that Alan Simons and his wife and their 3-year-old son were riding their bikes along a road, and that Simon's son was riding in a seat or a trailer bike attached to his bike. They said that Simon's was stopped by a 42-year-old Charles Dietz of Swannanoa, North Carolina, who began arguing with Simon's about the boy being on the bike in a high traffic area. They said that, get this, Dietz then pulled out a handgun and fired. Police said that Simons was struck in the helmet, and then they said that the bullet passed through the outer lining of the helmet, but didn't reach Simons' head. Dietz was charged with attempted first-degree murder and was being held on $500,000 bond. A bizarre story, a bizarre accident, and thank God the helmet was able to stop the bullet. And with that, here ends the news for this episode of the Fredcast. Before we get into this week's feature, it's time to thank our sponsor for this episode of the Fredcast, and that is Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/cycling and sign up now for your free audiobook and your free 14-day trial of the Audible Listener Gold Program. Audible is more than 60,000 audiobooks and more. We know you like to listen to spoken word entertainment because you're listening to this podcast and you're a loyal listener to the Fredcast, and we thank you for that. But if you go to Audible, you'll be able to listen to some of the most popular books, podcasts, and other audio entertainment with over 60,000 audiobooks for you to choose from, all compatible with your iPod, your iPhone, your Zune, and over 500 other devices, including possibly that GPS that you've got stuck on your windshield of your car right now. Again, go to audiblepodcast.com/cycling to check it out. My book recommendation this week, well, I guess I was a little hungry when I was trying to decide what I was going to recommend. It's a book called In-N-Out Burger, a behind-the-counter look at the fast food chain that breaks all the rules, written by Stacy Perman and narrated by Lauren Lester. Now, maybe you're not familiar with In-N-Out Burger, maybe you're not from the West Coast, but for those of us who grew up in Southern California, In-N-Out Burger is not just an icon, it's something you have to have on a regular basis. Matter of fact, when I went to college in San Diego, the closest In-N-Out Burger was, well, about an hour and a half's drive north up the 5 freeway, and yeah, I was in a fraternity, and yeah, I admit that we occasionally made the pledges go up and buy us In-N-Out Burgers, but listen to this story about people in Arizona and what they had to do before they got their own In-N-Out. This is straight from Audible.
"There are so many people excited about these stores coming to town," was how Dave Smith, a local real estate broker, described the thrill that blanketed the city. "It is like they are almost willing them out of the ground." For years, Arizona residents regularly drove across state lines in order to eat one of In-N-Out's vaunted double-double burgers. When In-N-Out opened its first Arizona store in the city of Scottsdale in 2000, Tucsonans got in their cars and made the 90-mile journey. While Scottsdale might not be considered convenient, it was certainly closer to Tucson than the Lake Havasu City location that opened the same year, which at a distance of 321 miles from Tucson was an unreasonable distance for a burger run, although not an entirely uncommon one. In fact, until In-N-Out first arrived in Arizona, many residents flew round trip between Phoenix and the Ontario International Airport in California expressly for a $2.75 hamburger.
Well, I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. And thank goodness In-N-Out is coming to Salt Lake City in just a couple of weeks. I can't wait for my own double-double. But until then, I'm going to enjoy In-N-Out Burger, a behind-the-counter look at the fast food chain that breaks all the rules. I'm going to be listening to it on my iPhone from Audible. You can too. Just go to audiblepodcast.com/cycling and sign up for your free trial of the Audible Listener Gold Program today. And we thank Audible so much for their continuing and continued support of the Fredcast. Well, for the past several months, we have all been riding along with Ken as he prepares for his journey to France and participation in the annual Étape du Tour and the climb of the vaunted Mont Ventoux. We've all been waiting for it. Ken's been training. We've been listening to how he's been getting it done. And now here is Ken to tell us about that day and what it was like to ride the Étape du Tour and Mont Ventoux. And this is probably the most unique Training with Ken segment because you really get the flavor of where he was in Provence, as you can hear the church bells chiming outside the window of the little village where he's staying in France. Also, he's bringing us some sounds of the day of the stage on Mont Ventoux as they waited for the racers to arrive. And then after the racers leave and Ken finds himself atop the summit of Mont Ventoux, he finds Andrew Messick from the Tour of California, and he does a great interview with Andrew about the upcoming Tour of California in 2010 and about those dates that are going to be conflicting with the 2010 Giro d'Italia. This is a great report. Listen all the way to the end. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Here's Ken and our final Training with Ken segment.
Hey, David, this is Ken, and it is July 26th and my final day here in France. It has been a fantastic 3 weeks, and I want to give you and your listeners an update on how the Étape du Tour went. First, I want to say that I absolutely could not have completed this ride without the fantastic coaching job that Rich Wharton at onlinebikecoach.com did. And I really hope that your listeners check his website out and give Rich a call if they're planning any type of major event, and even if they just want to really increase their cycling performance. Rich is a great guy and he'll do a great job for his clients. The other thing is that the modifications that I made to my bike, the compact crank, the 1227 cassette, the power tap, those things were all vital, all critical, and I'm glad that I did them. They really made it possible for me to finish up on Ventoux as strong as I possibly could. So here's the basic stats for the event. It was 106 miles, 170 kilometers. There were 11,927 feet of climbing. I burned about 3,000 calories. My average speed over the entire event was 13.1 miles an hour. My average power was 136 watts. And the event took me 8 hours and 7.5 minutes of actual riding time. Now, my official Étape time was a bit longer than that. It came in at 9 hours and 44 minutes, but that included a lot of waiting. There was about a half hour wait at the start because I was 7,000 people back, and there was another half hour waiting up about 6K from the summit at Chalet Renard because they ran out of water and I desperately needed water, and then just the normal food and rest stops along the way. So I placed 2,099 in my age category, and I'm 48 years old, and that is out of 2,700 people in that category. I placed 5,900th overall out of 9,500 entries, but about 2,100 people didn't finish the Étape. So, you know, I wasn't competitive in terms of trying to win this thing, but also I placed solidly in the middle, and I moved up almost a couple of thousand places from where I started. So All in all, I'm very happy with the results. There were a lot of people walking their bikes up Mont Ventoux, and I'm happy to say that I was not one of those people. So to give you a little bit of the story, the day before, as per Rich's plan, I did about a 45-minute ride. Rich suggested I do a 3-minute interval and follow that by a recovery drink to store up some calories. And I hit the sack at 10 o'clock. I was up for a 4 a.m. breakfast, and we were on the road to Montelamar by 4:30 in the morning. I was lucky enough to find a tour group called On Your Bike, and they're out of Ireland. Their website is onyourbike.com, and these guys were great. They let me share their bus. I was able to get a place in the same hotel as them, so it made getting to the start much less stressful than if I tried to do it myself. Traffic was just a complete nightmare all around Montelamar, so it was great to have an organized group to ride with. The start was at 7 o'clock, but like I said, I was 7,000 people back, so it took about half an hour to get out of the starting block. I basically followed Rich's plan in terms of drinking and eating on the road. I really, really made an effort to get a bottle of water and a gel down every hour. I used Perpetuum, which is a Hammer Nutrition product. And basically, a bottle of Perpetuum and a gel gives you about 300 calories. So that plus the occasional snack at a food stop, and I was consuming as much calories as my body could absorb in an hour. The etap was broken up into 4 smaller climbs, followed by Mont Ventoux. And the first few climbs were really pretty modest, 4 to 5% grade, 4 to 6 kilometers. But the peloton, if you want to call it a peloton, of 9,000 people was really all still bunched together over those first few climbs. So it was very nervous riding. People were jittery. There were crashes. There were ambulances coming up and down through the peloton, picking up people that had gotten hurt, obviously. And one person went down just a few feet in front of me, and I was lucky to swerve and avoid going down with them. So there was some actual danger on the ride. It was very, very crowded, and the streets are narrow and windy. And if you're hearing the church bells in the background, that's a good sign that I'm in a village in Provence, because I don't think they do that in Los Angeles very often. Anyway, I managed to get into some nice pace groups, and took advantage of some drafting when I could. But again, it was sketchy because people were moving in and out of the groups and they were passing slower riders. And so I was very, very careful just to protect myself from getting into a silly wreck and ruining the event much earlier than I would want to. The fourth climb out of that first batch is as you come out of the town of Salt, and that is the Col de Notre Dame de... Oh, I'm not even going to try to butcher this name. My French is about as good as yours, David. Let's just call it the Col de Notre Dame. And that's a 9-kilometer climb at about 7 to 9%. So it's really the first real climb of the ride. And I really, really tried to pace myself up that at a modest pace, because I didn't want to repeat my Solvang century mistakes and go out too hard too fast. So I just made sure to never let my wattage go past a good solid tempo pace, and my heart rate never went over what I consider a sustainable rate for myself, and I think it paid off in the end. The descent down from that col is just blazing fast. It is a wide highway, and it's a long, and the church bells like to repeat, just in case you didn't hear them the first time, they repeat again on the hour, so you know what the time is. Anyway, that descent, 40, 50 miles per hour, and people just flying down it. Big, broad roads, sweeping curves, nothing tricky. And it was a lot of fun, and it would have been a lot more fun to have done that on a closed road without, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 other people. Anyway, the next village that we hit was a village called Momoron, and there's another little climb coming through that village and out of it. Nothing steep, but by that time, you know, the legs are getting a little tired, and you can see Von Tu in the distance. So again, just taking it easy, stopped there for some fuel, and saw somebody in front of me decide to sort of stretch their legs out on the bike. Kind of, guy bent his leg up back and stretched out his calves and thighs, and I thought, oh, that's a good idea. My legs are a little sore. So I unclipped and reached and pulled my leg back, and man, my legs immediately started to cramp up on me. So I stopped that right away, kind of rubbed out my calf and thigh, and luckily the cramp went away right away. But lesson learned, I guess, don't try new stretching positions unless you're used to them. So we continued on from Momoron, headed to the village of Bedouin, which happens to be the village where my place is and where I'm staying with my family. So I had arranged for them to meet me with a big bottle of cold water, some ice, some snacks, some fruit. So I refilled my water bottles with ice and with Heed, because I was out of Perpetuum, and had one bottle with plain water and one bottle with Heed. And I took your advice, David. I'm using the chill packs, which I think are great. They kept the water nice and cold much longer than I'm sure a regular bottle would have. And also love the fact that you can just put those things up to your mouth and suck the water right out of them without having to fool with a cap. And I like you, that's my new favorite bottle now. So people should check those out if they haven't. Anyway, headed out of Bedouin after taking a few pictures with the family. And that's the climb to Von Tu, right, as you come around the corner at the end of town in Bedouin. And boy, once Von Tu kicks up about 4 or 5K into that climb, it just looked like a death march. People were exhausted. People were walking their bikes, laying on the side of the road. It was obvious that people either just went out way too hard, or perhaps just it was too much for them. But I was lucky that I still felt very good, and just continued to pace myself up the mountain. I had ridden Von Tu about a week before, so I knew where the tough parts of the climb were. I knew how long that climb is through the forest, and I knew how to pace myself going through there. You know, I wasn't in perfect condition. I was starting to get some little twinges of cramps. One of my feet were really sore. And so, you know, I still had to take it easy, and I did have to stop one time. I stood up on the pedals to push through a 14% bit of road, and my calf just cramped up on me really bad. So I stopped, got off the bike, and had to take a minute to just massage the leg and get it feeling good again. So again, lesson learned, I didn't stand up on the pedals and try to hammer anymore. I just kept the wattage steady, and the cramps never came back. So once you get through the forest, you hit the next rest stop, which is Chalet Renard, and that's the next place to get food and water, which I was really looking forward to, because I had finished my bottle of Heed, and I had dumped most of the bottle of fresh water on top of my head, because it was blazing hot and there was really not much shade. So pulled up to Chalet Renard, and wouldn't you know it, they were out of water. The only place on the entire etap that didn't have water. It was still another 6K up to the summit, and there was not an inch of shade to be found once you get out of the forest. So I definitely did not want to continue up without something to drink. So people were queuing up at the little gift shop because there was a water faucet there. And there was a line of about, oh, I don't know, 40 riders or so getting water from the gift shop. So I took my place in line, and that took probably about half an hour, which had I thought about it, I may not have done it just because it did add half an hour to my finish time. But at the same time, I may not have finished without the water. So I think in the end, it was probably a good idea to have that water, and maybe I should have grabbed an extra bottle from my wife down in bed one. Anyway, the last 6K, the first four of it is actually fairly modest. The road is about 7%, which after a 9 to 12% schlep through the forest felt like a recovery section. And that last couple of K is 10 to 12%, but by that time you've got the Tower of Ventoux in your sights, and it's pretty darn close, and you know you're going to finish. So a little bit of wind kicked up, which actually was nice, even though it was a little bit of a headwind, but it was cooling, and the weather was quite hot. It was in the 90s. So I just pushed on through and came through the summit, like I said, at about 8 hours of riding. Had a half of a Coke, which for some reason I don't drink Coke, but I was craving a Coke, and some bad cookies from one of the vendors up there. Took some photos and video and recovered, and then took the road back down to the other side of the mountain, which is the way they were directing all the riders. That was an adventure in itself. Quite a lot of cars heading down that mountain, and I had about another, 10 or 15K from the bottom of the mountain to where my car was parked at a village some distance from the bottom of the descent. Luckily, it was about a 1 or 2% downhill road, so I was able to just spin the legs out, and it actually was a little bit of a recovery for me. I had left at 7 in the morning. By the time I got to my car, it was 8 o'clock at night. So a 13-hour day, and I was home and in bed by 10, and all in all, it was a great, great day. I will send you a link for photos and video if your listeners are interested in checking out some of the pictures I took and some of the video I took. I did have my helmet cam on, but unfortunately on the ETAP, I had a little bit of a technical snafu with the helmet cam and didn't realize that I had neglected to delete the previous video off the helmet cam, so it was full. I did get some great helmet cam footage on the Ventoux stage of the tour, though, both riding up of the riders coming by and the descent coming down. So that's a lot of fun, and I think your listeners will be really interested in seeing some of that footage. So I'm going to leave you with some audio that I recorded while I was on the ETAP. And also, at the end of this, I've got a little surprise interview that I was able to grab with a gentleman who was staying in the tent up on Ventoux where I was watching the stage of the tour yesterday. And I think you and your listeners will enjoy that surprise bonus interview at the end. This is Ken. I'm here at the start of the ETAP, and there are just thousands and thousands of people stacked into Mont Alamar. It's quite exciting and a little intimidating. Here with a couple of the boys from On Your Bike. Well, in fact, this is Patrick. Patrick from On Your Bike. So what do you think about the start?
Oh, it's crazy. There's people everywhere. There's more people than there's room for. The pens are packed.
Patrick and his company were nice enough to give me a lift from the hotel in Vaison-le-Romaine. I went out for a ride with them the other day. It's a great group, and they do a real nice job with a group of guys prepping them for the ETAP, and they do some other tours as well. So I'll give you some more information about them, David. I think they're a really great resource for your listeners. And we'll talk to you again from somewhere on the ride.
David, this is Ken reporting from the summit of De Mont Ventoux, 1,910 meters of sheer torture. What a ride. It was as tough as I thought it would be and more, but I have to say that Rich did a great job of preparing me for it. I rode it the whole way. There were many, many people walking their bikes up Ventoux, people laying on the side of the road, and I'm happy to say that I was not one of them. a few small cramps just about, oh, a third of the way up, but I kind of rubbed him out and never saw him again. I followed Rich's program the whole way and felt like I finished pretty strong. Took about, I think my finishing time was 8 hours by my cycling computer, but that, of course, didn't count time stopping and eating and using the restroom and such. I think my official finishing time was 9 hours. So not even close to being competitive in terms of a race, but I finished it, and there's still a long stream of people coming up the Von 2, so I feel like I did a pretty good job. Anyway, I'll report more as I regain my faculties, and that's it from the Étape du Tour.
How'd you go on?
I'm here with two gentlemen from Manchester. How'd you like? I'm sorry, one from Manchester.
One from South Wales.
And one from South Wales. How was the ride?
Tough. Oh, tough. Hard going, yeah. Cramping for the last 12 kilometres or so, but really enjoyable.
First time doing the Étape?
Sure is, yeah.
Yeah? Would you do it again?
Yeah, despite the pain, yeah. Definitely.
I think everyone feels the same way. Congratulations, though.
Fantastic. Well done.
David.
Well, thank you for letting me train.
David, I'm here with a girl from California. What's your name?
Claire.
Claire. This is for a podcast, the Fredcast.
Okay, cool.
Claire from California. Where are you from in California?
Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz. I'm from Los Angeles.
Oh, sweet.
What was your time?
7:55.
Great time.
Yeah, thank you.
How'd you find the ride?
I actually just Googled, here.
How did you like the ride?
How did I like it? It kicked my butt.
It kicked your butt. That was a good time.
I'm stoked to be drinking a Coke and I'm still alive.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you, Claire.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, man.
All right, David, that's the last of my report from the Étape. And now I've got just a couple of short pieces from the Mont Ventoux stage of the Tour de France, which was yesterday. And I hope you enjoy them.
Hey, David, this is Ken reporting from Mont Ventoux, about 5 kilometers from the summit. And the caravan has just started to roll through. The tour is about, I want to say, maybe 40 kilometers from here. So they're not due for a little while, but all the advertising cars are rolling through, and it's a big party up here. So if you want to just get in some of the sounds you can hear in the background, I'll let that record for just a couple of minutes, or a couple of seconds. Anyway, that gives you an idea of the party that's going on up here on Mont Ventoux.
Get you,
hey, David, this is Ken, and I'm here at the Ventoux Summit, and I'm here with Andrew Messick, who heads up the Tour of California, and I thought I'd grab him, pull him aside from the tent, and just get a couple of words about the plans for next year for the Tour of California.
Well, I think the most important thing for the Tour of California is that we're shifting our dates from February, where we had the first 4 editions of the race, to May. And so we're going to be, the Tour of California this year will be the 16th to the 23rd of May. And we think that it's going to be a big step forward for our race. It's going to allow us to have better weather, more sunshine. It'll open up more parts of California and more terrain to the athletes and to the fans. And we think it's going to be a great opportunity to showcase professional bike racing in the United States.
So it sounds great. I think obviously the big controversy, if there is a little bit of a controversy, is the Giro time slot and the Tour of California at the same point. If you want to have any thoughts about that and how that might end up playing out for the fans and for the teams that'll come to California instead of Italy.
Well, we are going to be going head to head against the Giro. I think that there's enough outstanding riders and enough fantastic teams to be able to deliver a tremendous value to all of our fans. You know, the Giro is historically a very Italian race, and before Denis Menchov won last year and Contador the year before, I think 12 or 13 of the last 15 champions had been Italian. And I think there will be an impact on our race with respect to our ability to attract Italian riders. But with respect to our ability to attract riders who are preparing for the Tour de France, we think we're going to be able to continue to get a very attractive field of athletes who are focusing on the Tour de France. And we think that that we'll be able to showcase many of the very top riders who are performing here right now in France, and we'll have them with us in California in May of 2010.
Great. Thanks so much. I know for me, I'm living in California, it's one of my favorite events of the year. And David, I know you've watched it every year, so I'm sure all of your fans and all of your listeners are looking forward to seeing it in some great weather next year. And thanks for taking the time to share your thoughts.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Well, that's my coverage from France, David. It's been a great pleasure bringing this adventure to you and your listeners. And I hope we get to talk again soon in the future. Take care.
Wow. Once again, Ken, thank you so much. Not only did we get the report of your training, we got the report of your ride on the Étape du Tour and Mont Ventoux, and then the sounds of Mont Ventoux waiting for the racers to go by, and then that fantastic interview with Andrew Messick from the Tour of California. Thank you so much. Chapeau to you, monsieur, for what you did for yourself and also for your fellow Fredcast listeners. Thank you so very much. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Fredcast. I want to thank you for joining me. Thank you for staying subscribed. And of course, thank you for supporting the Fredcast through listening, telling your friends, through your donations, your subscriptions, and also through supporting our sponsors like this week's sponsor, Audible, audiblepodcast.com/cycling. For your free audiobook and your free 14-day trial. Check out that book about In-N-Out Burger. I know you'll find it interesting and entertaining, just as I did. Now, before we get to this week's PodSafe Cycling Music, do want to remind you how you can contact me and stay in touch with me. The best way to stay in touch with me day by day, sometimes minute by minute, is through Twitter. That's twitter.com/Fredcast. Of course, you can send me an email at any time. That's thefredcast@gmail.com. Our website is www.thefredcast.com, and you can send audio comments to the Fredcast listener hotline at area code 435-2586-FRED. That's 435-258-6373. And now it's time for our PodSafe Cycling Music, which tonight comes to us from the Mevio Alley, the former PodSafe Music Network, at music.mevio.com. Tonight's PodSafe Music is by a band called Chasing Red, and this song is called Stroker. It's been great being back. We'll see you again next week, but between now and then, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride.